Finally, parents, are you looking for a way to spend time you don't have doing something you'd rather not do? Then do what I did last Friday and play the newest game in town. The game is called Chase the Flu Shot. It was so much fun, I thought I'd share the rules with you. The whole thing says an awful lot about exactly what is wrong with our healthcare system. I'm not talking about the H1N1 vaccine, mind you. I'm talking about garden variety seasonal flu shots. I was trying to find them for our children and the lady who watches them after school. In the past, we've gotten flu shots at the school for my kids as well as their caregiver. My husband and I get our shots at our jobs. We pay $25 or $30 for each shot, which is not exactly cheap, but compared to the risks and costs of getting laid low with the flu, we've always thought it a worthwhile investment. But this year, the school clinic was canceled. Why? Not enough vaccine. Okay, so I call the pediatrician, get an appointment. So far, so good. Then not so good. Appointment canceled a few days later. Why? Not enough vaccine. So then I decided to play flu shot a go-go. I did what people in my neighborhood do. I got on the computer and asked my neighbors, anybody have a lead on flu vaccine? The answers poured in right away. Try this pharmacy website. Try that store clinic. Try this doctor's office. Try that government agency. I put the word out about 7 a.m. By 7 p.m. that night, we had our flu shots. The kids' arms were sore and their eyes were a little teary, but at least they got their flu shots. All told, it took me a couple of hours of detective work, checking websites and calling for availability, and the pizza I let them have to reward them for being brave and not screaming their heads off like they did last year when they got their shots. But can I just tell you, something is wrong with this picture. Why should it take me every spare minute of an entire day to comply with a guideline my government and most health experts have told me to follow? What if I had the kind of job where I could not make a personal phone call during the day, say like driving a city bus or teaching school for that matter? What if I didn't have the money to spare or a car to take me to any of the clinics I found, few of which were easily accessible by public transportation? What if I didn't have kind neighbors who knew what to do and were willing to share that information? I should mention my community held what was, by all accounts, a well-organized and well-executed H1N1 clinic over the weekend, which will continue into next week. It's for those at highest risk, kids and pregnant women. Now, that's great, but there are other communities where people are camping out overnight to get that vaccine. And why does this come at the expense of regular vaccines that we have all been told should be part of a proactive health plan, particularly when small children are involved, who may need to space out the timing of their injections? Now, how you react to all this may depend on who you are and what your expectations are. If you look at vaccine or health care in general as a scarce commodity and perhaps a privilege to get, like the tickets to a Bruce Springsteen concert, then by all means, we should expect to hustle for it. But if it's a matter of shared public interest, then why isn't it easier and cheaper to access? Similarly, if this were a poor or developing nation with difficulty in providing access to basic goods and services, then by all means, we would expect to spend hours securing the necessities of life. But this isn't a developing nation. The United States is a rich and powerful country, and we're constantly being told one with the best health care in the world. But you couldn't make that case based on what's happening right now in trying to combat something as simple as the flu. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Another piece of major legislation working its way through Congress would regulate the financial system. This week, the House Financial Services Committee, headed by Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank, is addressing problems posed by companies regarded as too big to fail. For insight, we turn to David Wessel. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Now, we have heard this phrase, too big to fail, so much over the last year, but would you mind briefly recapping for us exactly what the danger of an oversized financial firm might be?
Well, it's kind of a shorthand for an institution that is either too big or involved in too many markets or just too complicated for the government to allow it to fail, even if it gets in trouble. So we saw with Lehman Brothers that Lehman Brothers apparently was so big and so interconnected that when it failed, it nearly brought down the financial system. So now the government says, we're not going to let that happen anymore. The problem is this encourages firms to get so big or so complicated. They can borrow at favorable rates because the people who lend the money know the government will bail them out. They take bigger risks than is probably prudent. They get the winnings if the company does well, and the taxpayers get the bill if it doesn't.
What, then, is Barney Frank proposing?
Well, the final details of Barney Frank's proposal aren't out yet. He and the Obama administration have rejected the notion that the government should break up these big firms or even limit the businesses they can be into. Their line is sort of, we are stuck with firms that are awfully big or awfully complicated, so let's do things that make it less likely that they'll fail and create a system so that if they get in trouble, we have an alternative that's better than the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers or the bailout of AIG.
But would that also include something that would put taxpayers still on the hook?
Well, the plan is that if a firm gets into trouble, the government could take them over, much the way they can take over a conventional bank today and can decide who gets paid off and who doesn't. And the Frank legislation is going to say that the Treasury would come up with the money initially, but after such a rescue, the entire network of big financial firms would be assessed to pay for it to protect the taxpayers. Now, whether that'll work or not remains to be seen.
Yeah. Well, how does this fit in with other ideas that the administration has proposed to avoid a repeat of a financial crisis like we've just been through?
This thing is like a giant jigsaw puzzle with lots of different pieces. So the House has, for instance, already accepted, although watered down some, President Obama's proposal to create a new consumer regulatory agency on the theory that the existing bank regulators weren't worried enough about consumers. The committee is also working to change the way the government regulates these complicated securities called derivatives that were blamed for some of the crisis. And this week, Barney Frank's committee will also decide how much power should the Federal Reserve have and how much power should a new council of regulators have to oversee the whole financial system, because one of the issues here was that everybody was watching their little piece. No one was watching the whole, and that created an economic calamity.
Well, what about generally what regulators can do, if you will, without congressional approval? I mean, what are their limits there?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, the regulators are doing quite a bit without congressional. They don't need Congress to do a lot of things. So, for instance, the Fed is working with other regulators around the world to force banks to hold more capital, bigger capital cushions, so that when they get into trouble, they can absorb more of the blows themselves instead of laying them off on the taxpayers. And there's a number of regulatory steps and supervisory steps that they're taking now in order to tighten their oversight even while they wait for Congress to finish its work.
And just, we have a few seconds here. Let me go back to Barney Frank's proposal. He's, of course, in the House. How might what you've just been describing fare in the Senate?
Well, we really don't know. The House is moving. They'll probably have a bill on the floor by the end of the year. The Senate is not moving very fast and is unlikely to get to this before the end of this calendar year.
David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is economics editor of the Wall Street Journal.
People need comedy during tough times, but during the great stock market crash of 1929, there was a problem. Large numbers of entertainers lost everything, too. Well, this week is the 80th anniversary of the market crash, and NPR's Robert Smith went in search of what happened to humor.
In 1929, everything was booming. The stock market, radio, movies, and riding that wave were four brothers named Marx. Groucho, Chico, Harpo, and Zeppo were even making their first talking movie about a speculative bubble, the Florida land rush.
Do you know that property values have increased 1929 since 1,000%?
You told me about this yesterday.
I know, but I left out a comma.
But the Marx brothers were obsessed with a different kind of investment. After Groucho finished filming each scene, he'd call his broker. Groucho had stuffed all of his money into stocks.
He became just your classic innocent investor. He didn't have a clue what was happening. He didn't know why the prices went up when they did.
Maury Klein is a professor of history and the author of Rainbow's End, The Crash of 1929.
Every day he'd go in and he'd look at on the big board and he'd see that his stock had climbed X number of prices. And he'd made several thousand dollars without lifting a finger. And he thought, well, this is easy.
I'll have to see my broker, find out what he can do, 'cause I'm in the market for you.
show business and Wall Street hadn't always mixed, but by 1929, everyone was in the market. The Marx Brothers were getting hot tips from Joe Kennedy. They even left an audience waiting one afternoon because they were trying to buy up shares of Anaconda Copper. You'd think they would have known better, since the entire plot of their movie, Coconuts, was about bad investments.
You can have any kind of a home you want to. You can even get stucco. Oh, how you can get stucco. Now is the time to buy while the new boom is on. Remember that old saying? A new boom sweeps clean. And don't forget the guarantee. If these lots don't double in value in a year, I don't know what you can do about it.
Groucho was very conservative. But there's this increasing belief that almost becomes a fantasy, that all you have to do is put your money in the market and the story will have a happy ending, which, of course, in Hollywood is supposed to happen.
But not on Wall Street. Their script called for a tragedy. Over 6 days at the end of October 1929, the stock market plunged by a third. Groucho Marx later recalled the exact words from his financial advisor. "Marx," he said, "the jig is up." Groucho lost $250,000. He later joked that he would have lost more, but that was all the money he had. Harpo was also wiped out. Their friend and fellow vaudevillian, Eddie Cantor, was no longer a millionaire.
"Well, folks, they got me in the market just as they got everybody else. I know thousands and thousands of married men who will have to leave their sweethearts and go back to their wives."
Cantor was left with $60 in his pocket and a debt of $300,000.
"Personally, I shouldn't worry about my stocks. I know my broker is going to carry me. Yes, sir. He and three other pallbearers."
Sure, it was dark, but at least they were still making jokes. You have to remember, stocks had crashed before and then gone right back up. The Great Depression was a year off, and there was still a hope that everyone could laugh this whole thing off. Singer Arthur Fields.
"I'm the chump you've heard about. There's more like me, without a doubt. When stock reports are given out, oh, what a sucker. My stocks come tumbling down. My stocks come tumbling down. When I listened to the ticker tick, I figured I could get rich quick. But the bunch of bears were too darn slick. My stocks come tumbling down."
Groucho Marx still didn't think it was funny. The Marx Brothers were scheduled to do a show in Baltimore right after the crash, and Groucho couldn't go on. He was sick, depressed. The crash of 29 gave him insomnia that he never recovered from. Groucho's next movie was Animal Crackers, and you could tell the whole thing still haunted him.
"Hideous stumbling footsteps creaking along the misty corridors of time. And in those corridors I see figures, strange figures, weird figures. Steel 186, Anaconda 74, American Can 138.
The audience would have recognized those stocks, but by the time the movie was released, Anaconda Copper had dropped even lower. It would go down to $3 a share. That's why in the movie Horse Feathers, Groucho was using the stock name as a swear word.
"Jumping Anaconda."
They couldn't know it at the time, but the Marx Brothers and Eddie Cantor and the rest of the comedians would have the last laugh. The movie business was one of the few industries not devastated by the Great Depression, and the Marx Brothers' cynical brand of humor was perfect for the mood of the public. They were soon rich again. But they didn't forget. In 1937, a day at the races, Groucho buys into a horse-picking scam that seems awfully familiar.
"Come on, you want to win?"
"Want to win, but I don't want the savings of a lifetime wiped out in the twinkling of an eye."
It's the one line in the movie where Groucho seems dead serious. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The debate over health care has two parts. There's a very loud public discussion. There's also the private negotiation.
And it was the private talks that led a key part of the health care plan to resurface this week. Senate Democrats came up with a bill that includes a government-sponsored insurance plan or public option. It would compete with private companies. Now the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid faces the challenge to round up enough votes for it. NPR's David Wellner reports.
The Senate's new health care legislation blends huge bills passed by two committees. The legislation itself hasn't been made public. First, the Congressional Budget Office has to give it a price tag. But aides say much of it closely tracks the more conservative bill passed by the Finance Committee. For instance, it has no requirement for employer-provided insurance, and it's paid for in part by taxing expensive insurance plans. But one thing the finance bill did not have that the more liberal Health Committee bill did was a public option. option. Yesterday, Majority Leader Reid said the chairman of those two committees, as well as the White House, all agreed the best way forward was to include such a public option, which individual states could opt out of until the year 2014.
The public option is not a silver bullet. I believe it's an important way to ensure competition at a level of playing field for patients with the insurance industry.
Still, a number of more conservative Senate Democrats have expressed strong misgivings about a public option. Every one of their votes is important because in the Senate it takes 60 votes to overcome a filibuster, and the Democrats have precisely 60 members in their caucus. Pressed by reporters on whether he actually has those 60 votes, Reid seemed confident.
As soon as we get the bill back from CBO and people have a chance to look at it, which they'll have ample time to do that, I believe we clearly will have the support of my caucus to move to this bill and start legislating.
One senator who likely won't be voting with the Democrats when their health care bill hits the Senate floor is the only Republican in Congress who's voted for such a bill in committee, Maine's Olympia Snow. She put out a statement yesterday saying she was deeply disappointed that a public option would be in that bill. Reid said he hoped Snow would eventually come around on the issue.
We hope that Olympia will come back. She's worked hard. She's a very good legislator. I'm disappointed that the one issue, the public option, has been something that has frightened her.
Other Senate Republicans immediately derided Reid's opt-out public option. John Cornyn of Texas, who's a member of the GOP leadership team, called it a brand new entitlement program.
And I would urge my colleagues not to take the bait on this so-called public option, whether it has an opt-out or not, because it is just another disguised way to try to end up with a single-payer, government-run health care system here out of Washington, D.C.
Another member of the GOP leadership, Tennessee's Lamar Alexander, said there already is an opt-out government-run health plan, the Medicaid program that covers nearly 60 million poor and disabled people.
The first thing to know about a government-run health insurance program, which states can opt out of, is that they really can't. I mean, in the real world, they really can't. None has.
That prompted a sharp retort from the Senate's number two Democrat, Dick Durbin. He said the opt-out public option would be nothing like Medicaid, in which the government dictates payment levels for Medicaid providers. Durbin said the public option would have to negotiate payment levels with providers, just as private insurers do.
I think there is fairness to it, allowing each state to make the decision on what it will do based on the needs of the people who live in that state. And the people of the state will have the final say at the next election as to whether the legislature and the governor made the right choice.
Democrats are clearly betting state governments would feel pressured by constituents not to opt out of a public option. But that's assuming the opt-out public option survives the legislative gauntlet and tests of party cohesion that lie ahead. As Durbin said of his fellow Senate Democrats yesterday, "We agree on some things, but there's disagreement when it comes to other things." David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
Right now, NASA is counting down to a launch at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. That's pretty routine. What's unusual is that NASA won't be launching one of the space shuttles. Instead, weather permitting, they'll launch the first test flight of a new rocket that might carry astronauts into orbit after the old space shuttles become museum exhibits. Here to tell us more is NPR science reporter Nell Greenfield-Boyce. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, the space shuttles have been flying for a generation, more than 25 years. How is this new rocket different?
Well, the new rocket being tested is called Ares 1X. It's an experimental version of NASA's planned Ares 1 rocket, and it's really tall. It's about 327 feet, and it's also skinny. So on the launch pad, it looks very different from the bulky shuttle. And it's more like in the days of Apollo, when astronauts would sit in a capsule on top of a rocket. And that may sound like a throwback, but the thinking is that this is a safer design.
And I gather no astronauts will be on board this test flight. What is the goal?
Yeah, there will be no astronauts on board. It's an unmanned test. The crew capsule is actually just a mock-up, not the real thing. And some of the rocket parts are just stand-in, too. They're just the right size and weight for the test. So no people, but there will be hundreds of sensors. And the rocket is going to go about 28 miles up. Nothing's going to go into orbit, nothing like that. But there will be 2 minutes of powered flight that will give NASA lots of data on how this design withstands the stresses of liftoff.
And when the space shuttles are retired next year, if it all goes to plan, would this new rocket be ready?
Not next year. NASA is now aiming for 2015, although some experts think it'll be more like 2017 or even later.
How will American astronauts get into space in the meantime if they need to now?
Well, the current plan is to buy rides from Russia. Basically, American astronauts would ride up in Russian capsules. But the White House is considering the future of NASA and what to do. And it just got a report last week from an expert panel it got together to look at the future of NASA. And this panel was actually fairly critical of the new rocket that's about to be tested. They said it might have been a wise plan several years ago, but times have changed. And they said development's been delayed. There have been budget cuts. There have been technological problems. And so they said maybe the Ares 1 rocket should be canceled in favor of something else.
And that something else might be what?
Well, they specifically mentioned private companies that are building rockets that could take crew and cargo up into orbit close to the Earth. The panel said that basically that would allow NASA to focus on building bigger and more ambitious rockets that could go farther and do more. And so some people think this flight test of the Ares 1 rocket might really be kind of a swan song. They think the rocket's on shaky ground and that this could be the end instead of the beginning.
Well, if that's the case, why are they launching this test flight?
Well, a lot of people still think it's a good idea to do the test flight because, you know, full-scale rocket tests don't come around that often. This has been in the works for a long time, and people in charge say this is going to be useful to rocket science no matter what rocket is built. Basically, they're going to get a ton of real-world data that they can compare to their computer models. I mean, most rockets are designed now using computers, and so they don't get the opportunity that often. It's expensive to do this kind of thing, and they say that, you know, by doing this, they're going to have something real that they can compare to all the designs and sort of things they brought up on the drawing board.
Nell, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce on NASA's plans to launch a new test rocket.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today we're starting a series of stories about privacy, or as we are calling the series, The End of Privacy. NPR's Martin Kosty is here with us at NPR West. Martin, that title is your idea. You're calling it The End of Privacy. So the message there, forget about privacy. It's over.
Well, it's not necessarily what I'm saying, but what struck me over the last couple of years as I've done stories about privacy is how many people say this to me. They say they've given up. The technologies have become too fast. They're too good at collecting data. And in some ways, I'm hearing a lot of people say that they've sort of succumbed to what I'm calling privacy fatalism.
Privacy fatalism sounds like a pretty gloomy future to me.
Well, it's what we're going to try to look at in this series to see if that fatalism is justified. And I think a good place for us to start today is just looking at what kind of information is really out there. So, for instance, you've got a computer in front of you here in the studio. Take a look at this website. Type in nextmark.com.
Nextmark.com.
And when you look there, you see that it's a searchable site. It's sort of the Google of mailing lists. Put in a search term, let's say something medical, because that's what people care about. Bladder, perhaps?
Bladder. Okay.
That might lead to
searching something. All mailing lists for bladder, coming up with bladder leakage database, bladder sufferers, all kinds of.
Now, these are
like
not just statistics. These are lists of people's names, their addresses, their phone numbers sometimes, tied in with their medical conditions, sometimes medical conditions that I would assume they would not want necessarily for sale, and yet here they are for sale. This has always happened in the past, of course. There's always been ways for marketers to get information about, say, our medical conditions from warranty cards for things we fill out or magazine subscriptions. But all of that is accelerating, and what we have now is sort of a switch from dial-up speeds to broadband speeds for the flow of this information into this vast data pool.
We should say I don't see the names popping up here. I would have to pay money to have access to.
You would have
to
pay money.
Them.
You can buy per thousand and so forth. It's definitely a commodity.
Are there regulations, Martin, on how much information these companies can collect, what kind of information they can gather?
Not really. This kind of data is pretty much unregulated in the United States. It's not legal for your doctor or your hospital to sell your medical data, of course. That is prohibited by federal law. But if you voluntarily give up your information, all the law cares about is where the information came from. Now, the industry, of course, is very adamant that it's careful, that the reputable firms aren't selling this information to just anybody. Yes, you can look at the website and see that it's for sale, but they still want to know more about you before they sell it to you. I actually called the founder and CEO of Nextmark, the site you were looking at there. His name is Joe Pitch. And he said that consumers should also keep in mind that there are some benefits to companies knowing more about us.
I think when it's done right, just as with a good friend, sharing personal information makes for a much more relevant and meaningful relationship. And without that, you're really just a number.
And this is really the crux of the issue, because people do use their personal information to get stuff, to get good relationships with companies, to get coupons, bonuses, that sort of thing. They trade their personal information. And they do it to the point where it's actually becoming a subject for economists.
Those exchanges happen daily, constantly.
That's Alessandro Acquisti. He's an Italian economist who specializes in privacy. And the way he sees things, personal information is almost a kind of currency. It's something we spend. But there's a problem.
We don't have infinite cognitive power and processing power to consider all the different options. And we take shortcuts.
Acquisti studies these shortcuts that we take. He studies how people make gut decisions about which information to disclose about themselves. For example, online. It turns out that, according to his experiments, we're influenced by website design.
People admit more sensitive, even embarrassing or illegal behaviors to a website which has been designed to look kind of cheesy.
In his experiments, he's found that subjects are more likely to admit to, say, cheating on their girlfriend or something when the questions are on this cheesy, fun-looking website. But a more formal-looking website asking the same questions gets a lot more caution and a lot more self-censorship.
So, Martin, you're saying that people sometimes will decide whether they want to share their information based on a gut instinct, but you could also be pretty rational about this, I suppose. You could read a company privacy policy and make an informed decision about what you're disclosing.
That's very true, and some people make that effort. They read the fine print. But even the experts, the people who are privacy gurus, say that's becoming harder to do. Because you may see a privacy policy there, but it's pretty much impossible in most situations to know where your data is going if they are sending it anywhere. It's hard to follow it through the system. Chris Hufnagel is the head of privacy programs at Berkeley Law, and he explained some of this to me.
As there's been growing awareness of how commercial data brokers operate, they've become more secretive.
We were talking in a park in San Francisco a few weeks ago. And when we met, Chris immediately opened up his laptop because he wanted to show me something.
This is an archive.
He's been saving screenshots of the websites of the big data companies over time. He's been saving screenshots of what they say about where their data is coming from. The formal term for this is data provenance. As recently as 2002, in his screenshots there, you can see that this particular data company still disclosed some details about the commercial sources of the data. It listed things like call centers or pizza delivery companies that sold information to them. But lately, that's changed.
As time goes on, this gets thinner and thinner. So pizza companies falls off the list. And then by 2006, the provenance is gone.
Nothing listed for provenance?
They basically say things like, the process includes proprietary files. That essentially means it's sources that they've gathered, but they won't tell you what those sources are.
Now, it should be noted that data brokers have good business reasons to keep their sources secret. They may be trade secrets or something the other guy hasn't discovered. But Hufnagel also believes that there is some political motivation behind this.
If consumers knew the extent to which this information was being collected and repackaged, there would be riots in the streets.
Riots in the streets,
Yeah, it's
Martin.
a bit of an overstatement, and, you know, he cares deeply about these things. But there is some truth to the fact that American privacy laws have traditionally been driven by scandals. That's why, for example, we have federal protections for our video rental records. It's because there was a dust-up in the 80s because someone published the lineup for Judge Robert Bork's personal movie nights.
Oh, right.
So that's why we have that protection. It's always about a scandal. And now as data companies are beginning to extend their reach into interesting new areas, like social networks, it's probably a smart thing to keep some of those new sources below the radar.
You're talking about social networks like Facebook, for example. How valuable would that kind of data be?
Well, you remember how Alessandro Acquisti was talking about the cheese factor?
Yes.
Well, the fact is that people are less inhibited about themselves on informal websites. And that's true on social sites especially. And data companies now know that. They want that information that you're sharing so freely about yourself on social sites. And that's what tomorrow's story is all about.
Okay, NPR's Martin Costi, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You can find more from our series, The End of Privacy, at npr.org. There's a breakdown of some of the costs and rewards of sharing your personal information.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.